The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Hello there, folks. Welcome once again to the City Bible Forum. If this is your first time here today, my name is Ken West, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you here. So our good friend David Old will speak for us in a moment on Jonah, which is a part of the old Jewish Bible. It was probably written between 500 and 700 BC. I'm going to read this part of Jonah's story and then hand over to David. Now, just a bit of background. Jonah has been a storm, he's been thrown into the ocean, and he's been swallowed by a fish. So let's pick up Jonah's story. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God, and he said, "In my distress I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave I called for help, and you listened to my cry. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled about me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. I said, 'I've been banished from your sight, yet I will look again towards your holy temple.' The engulfing waters threatened me, the deep surrounded me, seaweed was wrapped around my head, to the roots of the mountains I sank down. The earth beneath barred me in forever, but you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord my God. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. Salvation comes from the Lord." And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Ken. Good to be with you guys again as we make our way through what I'm increasingly convinced is the comedy story of Jonah. Now, I don't know what you think, but it seems to me less and less people are taking Anzac Day seriously. Last year, the main debate was over whether people should be given an extra day's holiday on Monday to make up for the fact that Anzac Day fell on a Saturday. The Sydney Morning Herald of the week before Anzac Day reported the national president of the RSL saying this: "People make good excuses for a long weekend and don't participate in commemorative events." His name is Major General Cruz. "If they were serious," he said, "they would stay in town." They were serious, they'd stay in town. And yet, despite this apparent lack of seriousness, Anzac Day and the Anzac spirit still has a major grip over this nation. It's still one of those defining aspects, isn't it, of who we are. But that rebuke from Major General Cruz, "If they were serious, they would stay in town," could equally well have been made of Jonah, who we're reading about today and saw last week, because he shows, let's be clear on this, Jonah shows an equal lack of sincerity about what is actually a far bigger issue than even Anzac Day. And Anzac Day is very important. And the issue on which Jonah shows what I think you have to call hypocrisy is the grace, the mercy of God. And the abounding, the overflowing mercy of God is, as we began to see last week as we looked at Jonah, the major theme. And the only guy who seems doesn't get it is Jonah himself. Now, if you remember, as we saw last week, Jonah was a prophet of God around 780 BC in the nation of Israel. God comes to him, chapter 1, verse 1, and says, "Go to the city, the great city of Nineveh, and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me." And God says, "Go to Nineveh, tell them I am angry with them for their wickedness." Of course, what does Jonah do? Doesn't go. He buys a ticket on a boat going west. He goes far, far west, away from Nineveh. And as we saw last week, God sends a terrible storm that threatens to sink the boat that Jonah's on, so he suggests maybe that he is the problem. The sailors end up throwing him overboard, and he's left for dead. And yet, a great fish is sent by God to swallow him up. And that's where we join him. Jonah is in the fish, sitting there with a lot to think about. And indeed, he has been thinking, because as our passage opens up today, it's chapter 2 of the book of Jonah, he opens his mouth and he prays to God. And I've used some big words here. It is what I want to call an honorable orthodoxy. It's actually quite a magnificent prayer. It's full of what I want to call honorable orthodoxy. Everything that Jonah says here is correct. I'm a minister, trust me on this. It's a great prayer. It honors God as right thinking about spiritual things should do. The first thing you see Jonah say is that he has been saved by God from what he eventually calls the pit. So, for example, in verse 2, you have this. From the depths of the grave, I called for help, and you listened to my cry. And again, in verse 6, he says this. You brought my life up from the pit, O Lord my God. And the word that Jonah here uses for grave or pit is the same word in the original language Hebrew. It's a word called Sheol, which can mean a grave, but actually also is used to speak about the place where dead people went, the place from where there is no escape. And then Jonah speaks of that truth in a number of other ways. So, for example, verse 3, here's what he says. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the currents swirled around me. And again, verse 6. To the roots of the mountains I sank down. The earth beneath barred me in forever. Now, obviously, it's poetry, it's poetic language, but it still expresses a very sure and certain truth. Jonah was dead. Or he was as good as dead. Indeed, it's hard to imagine how he would not have drowned very quickly were it not for God's intervention. This was a miraculous escape from a deserved death. He was, remember, a woefully disobedient man. He was a prophet who refused to pass on the message from God. And Jonah actually knows it. The language he uses passes beyond that of simple physical death into something more serious. It passes beyond that to judgment. Let's look at how Jonah expresses that. So, for example, in verse 4, here's what he says. I said, I have been banished from your sight. Now, it is in the Bible a terrible thing to be banished from the sight of God, to have him remove his gaze from you. Our youngest little boy is 13 months old, and our family, we just spend a lot of time looking at him. And in his first year of life, we just did a lot of that. I was looking at him looking at us. He couldn't speak, he still can't. His only words are papa and kaka. That's all he's got. He couldn't understand what we were saying. We couldn't understand him at all. And yet, there was great intimacy of relationship simply in the sight, in the looking. In fact, being able to look someone in the eyes is often the heart of relationship, isn't it? And when people turn their face away from you, well, you know you're in trouble. Here it is God who's banished Jonah from his sight. And he puts it in other ways. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the sea. The currents swirled around me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. And again, the deep, verse 5, surrounded me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. This language is really deliberate. In the Bible, there is one prevailing image of God's judgment. That image is a flood. Time and time again, the biblical writers pick up that imagery to express God's right and determined punishment of wickedness. And the language of the deep that Jonah uses here is exactly the same used back in Genesis 7 in the Bible when the flood is sent. On that day, we're told all the springs of the great deep burst forth. And so Jonah is deliberately using the same words again. But that doesn't even exhaust the imagery. The language of seaweeds resonates with another flood of judgment. This time the Red Sea, or more accurately it's called the Sea of Reeds, the Sea of Weeds. And that's the great story, isn't it, in Exodus, where God rescues the people of God from Egypt and takes them through the Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea. When they're through, and the Egyptian army chases them, God closes up the sea, and the Sea of Reeds swallows up. The Sea of Weeds swallows up the Egyptian army. It's another powerful image of judgment. And from all this, Jonah says, he has been rescued by God. And that, of course, is the great news of the gospel, isn't it? That is what the Bible says the good news of the gospel is. The gospel is, the good news is, God saves us, despite the fact that we deserve punishment. It's wonderful news, and Jonah knows it. The right response to being saved, of course, is to praise God. And so Jonah does that, verse 8. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I've vowed, I'll make good. Salvation comes from the Lord. So Jonah says, pagans, Gentiles, non-Jews, they all worship idols. That's offensive to God. You'll never see God's grace if you snub him in that way, but not me, says Jonah. I don't do that. I live for the true God. I sing songs of thanks. I make sacrifices. Salvation comes from the Lord. I'll never forget it. All of it is honorable orthodoxy. It honors God, and it's true. But Jonah doesn't actually believe a word of it, does he? You see, Jonah is a hypocrite. He is a hypocrite. But despite knowing the truth and saying it, Jonah was a heartless hypocrite. Just compare what he prayed to what he actually did. So did Jonah actually go to a city full of worthless, full of people who clung to worthless idols? No, he didn't. What did Jonah do when presented with that choice? He ran away. He refused to even give them the chance to forfeit the grace that could be theirs. Instead, what did he do? He got on a boat with a bunch of other pagans. And of course, when the storm blew up, they did first cling to their worthless idols. But when it became clear that the God of Jonah, the true God, was responsible for the storm, they came around very quickly. So remember this from last week, chapter 1 and verse 16. At this time, the men, that's the sailors, greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. Do you see what's going on here in the book? Jonah talks about it, but the pagans were the ones that actually did it. Jonah was thrown into the sea of God's judgment, and the pagans, non-Jews, they were back on the boat, saved by God's grace, sacrificing and making vows. In fact, remember, this is a very Jewish book. But what you have here is Jonah the Jew becoming a drowning non-Jew, little better than Pharaoh and the rest of them swept away in the Red Sea. And the Gentiles, the pagans on the boat, well, they start acting like faithful Jews. It's brilliant. It's comedy. And now, in the belly of the fish, Jonah says to God, those pagans, they know nothing about you. They don't know about your grace. They never will. And then how about this one? How about this one? I'll go back, sorry. In my distress, says Jonah, I called to the Lord. It's just not true, is it? If you were around last week and read through Jonah chapter 1, you'll know it's not true. As the storm raged, the sailors were up on the deck and they were crying out. Same words that Jonah uses here for call out. They were crying out, chapter 1 verse 14, for God to save them. What was Jonah doing? He was asleep under the deck. And when he's finally aroused, he just announces it's his fault and they should kill him. There's no crying out to God from Jonah. It's just all a lie. It's the truth. Jonah says it, but he doesn't believe it. But of course, it's tempting to dismiss Jonah as a one-off. Normal, sensible people surely aren't like this. But actually, we find out that this is the regular way that religious people tend to behave. So let's turn now to a little section in Matthew's Gospel. I'm going to just show you a little bit of stuff in Matthew's Gospel, where Jesus meets a bunch of religious leaders who come and ask him for a sign. These guys are Pharisees, teachers of the law, experts in the Old Testament. They would have been honorably orthodox. They ask Jesus for a miracle, and they just want Jesus to prove who he is. And people today do the same thing, don't they? I can't think of the number of, can't count the number of people who said to me, if only Jesus would appear, then I'd believe. I just want to see a miracle, that kind of thing. It's always been the same. And Jesus blasts them for it. And he says to them, you will not get a sign except the sign of Jonah. Just as Jonah was 3 days and nights in the belly of the fish, says Jesus, so he will be 3 days and nights in the earth. There's your proof, says Jesus. And of course, what he's telling them is that they've had enough signs. And only one sign remains, the resurrection of Jesus. And see, there's deep irony there as well in this encounter between Jesus and the Pharisees. For the religious leaders that rebuke him are the same ones who will put him to death. They think they can kill him, but he is raised again, as it was in the days of Jonah, so it actually is in the days of Jesus. So what about us? There's a bunch of you here today who are Christians. You're signed up for Jesus. I want to talk to you briefly for a minute. And if you're here and you're not a Christian, just listen in as I chat to as I chat in a little in-house conversation. I reckon the challenge here for us, first of all, if we're Christians, is to beware of the hypocrisy of Jonah. I've had a couple of conversations this week with people who have been put off Jesus because they have met honorably orthodox, heartless hypocrites. People who knew all the right things, ticked all the boxes, but when it came to it, did not act with grace and mercy. We can know all the right truths, we can be experts in the Reformation, we can know our Bibles inside out, but if we're like Jonah, if we're heartless, if we don't understand the grace of God, it's no good at all, friends. It's no good at all. It's no good at all. And friends, if you're here today and you're not a Christian, that is to say, if Jesus is not your king and you're not signed up for this, again, great to have you with us, But can I just say, the book of Jonah is written for people like you so that you might understand that although you have met heartless hypocrites, that is not what the Bible displays the gospel as being at all. So you are meant to stand and mock Jonah with us, to understand that Jonah is not a role model for a Christian man or a woman. Now, next week, we're going to stop and see Jonah actually arrive at Nineveh and see if he learns his lesson. But for now, let's just stay and think about what it would mean for Jonah to have stayed in the city, because he didn't. He ran away and then says this prayer, which is not true at all. We're left hanging with Jonah, still getting it all wrong, and wondering if God himself might start to make things right. Now, I guess now is the time for us to take some questions. As Ken said, you can do that in a number of ways. You can simply raise your hand and speak out if you're feeling brave, or you might want to write something down. I'll pop it on a piece of paper. Why don't I just give you about a minute if you want to do that, and then we'll start again. How does that sound, Ken? Sure. So the question is, sorry, I've forgotten your name. Jan says when she's reading through this passage ahead of time, she went, oh, it looks like Jonah's being sincere. This looks like a genuine repentance, a genuine turning back to God. That was my first impression when I read it. But then two things persuade me that's not what's going on. First is the fact, as we will see next week, Jonah reverts to type. As soon as he arrives in Nineveh, he actually reverts to type. So he becomes the man that didn't want to go to Nineveh in the first place when he actually arrives in Nineveh. I'm not going to steal my thunder on that next week, but there it is. Secondly, I think the thing that made me convinced that's not what's going on is that all the use of the language mirrors what actually happened on the boat. So there's specific words and little phrases that get used, and you see it more in the original Hebrew than you do in the English. There's little turns of phrases and even bits where the Hebrew almost sounds the same, where it's deliberately mirroring what happened on the boat. But you actually realize it's not what happened on the boat. And so there's a deliberate irony, I think, built into the song. Everything he says he did is actually not what's going on. And given the fact that when he gets out of the fish, so next week he's going to be spat out near Nineveh, he reverts to type. Either he stays the same, which is to think what's going on, in which case it's a deeply ironic, which actually makes sense given where the book's going, because we'll see where the book ends up. Or he's unfaithful, then he's faithful, then he's unfaithful again. So I think it makes more sense to read Jonah as a consistent character, consistently throughout, not understanding the mercy of God. I think you get more of a sense. And actually, then the book's deep and rich irony works much better. I think that's the way it was originally intended. But it's a question of debate. And I certainly had some Christians older and wiser than me after I preached this in the church where I work, questioning that. But I explained to them why I think it's otherwise. I think it just makes more sense this way. Yep, did ask the same thing, and I said to them what I said to you. I said, I don't think the whole book portrays a Jonah who's unfaithful, faithful, unfaithful. I think it's more accurate to view him as consistently unfaithful. And then actually the ironies in the book work better, and the whole thing just, I think, is more cohesive. And we'll see next week what his preaching is actually like. Because even then, I don't want to steal my thunder for next week. But yeah, even his preaching is pretty, it's useless. Yeah, but God's not useless, as we'll see next week. Thanks. So yeah, hold your fire on that for next week. Because it's brilliant. When he actually gets into Nineveh. Well, if you've got the time before next week, go and read chapters 3 and 4 and see what actually happens. It's brilliant. Any other questions? Absolutely. So I'm sorry, I rushed over it. I realize I rushed over it. The Pharisees come to him and they say, show us a sign. And of course, he's already shown them. He's already done plenty of stuff. You know, there's miracles, there's raising of people from death, there's healings, there's feeding of massive numbers of people. And they're like, go on, show us another one. Prove it. And he just goes, there ain't nothing left for you to see. Just one more sign, the sign of Jonah. I'll be buried in the ground just like he was in the fish. I'm going to come out alive. That's the sign for you. And even then, I think, as you reflect upon what's going on in Jonah, and the great irony of Jonah, one of the religious leaders of Israel, not getting it, not understanding the grace and the mercy of God, Jesus throwing that sign at them, because they're the ones that are going to kill him, is a beautiful irony. If you want to learn sarcasm, the best place is to get it from Jesus. He is the most rippingly sarcastic man I've ever come across. Just you read through him. Whenever Jesus takes on a Pharisee, he's usually going to chop them down at the knee. and make fun of them. And I think he does that with his even with his sign. Yeah. There's a deep irony in that. I think that's what's going on there. Yeah. So it's more than simply saying, I'm going to come out of the ground, which of course is what he's saying. He's actually saying, that's the only sign left for you. An undoing of your rejection of me.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.